Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people that I have had the privilege of knowing in 40-some years working in this space who have done more and who are continuing to do as much as our guest for this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. He is Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, the capstone of an extraordinary 36-year highly decorated career in the United States Navy, which saw him rise through the ranks from able-bodied seaman to four-star admiral. He has been a prolific contributor since leaving the military to the public policy debate about national security, notably in the op-ed pages of places like the Washington Times, these days the Canadian Free Press. He is the president and CEO of Lyon Associates, LLC, and I'm proud to say the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. Admiral Lyons, it is an honor to have you with us, sir, as always, and thank you so much for giving so generously of your time today to work through a lot of issues weighing on you, I know, and that should be a top of mind for all the rest of us as well. Good to have you, sir.
Well, it's nice to be back with you, Frank, and your listeners.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to start with what I anticipate will be an extended conversation with you, Admiral, about the nation that you interacted with quite a bit and have spent a lot of time focused on, both in uniform and out, now rising ever more inexorably as an adversary, indeed a threat, namely Communist China. And you wrote recently a piece that I thought was very important about the adversarial nature of the Chinese at the moment, and in particular, the need for a regional strategy to confront them. And I want to go through your recommendations in turn, but give us just sort of at the 30,000-foot level a characterization of how you see the Chinese today, and then we'll get into some of the details of how the challenge it poses is manifesting.
Well, it should be no surprise to anybody that we're being challenged on multiple fronts by the Chinese, very aggressively with their expansionist policies and their maritime imperialism. And in that I include their One Belt, One Road strategy, that is building bases on a global nature and encumbering less than thriving economic nations with a tremendous burden of debt. But this is all part of the Chinese strategy to expand their global reach. And for example, when I say maritime imperialism, I'm talking about those artificial islands that they built in the South China Sea out of rocks and shoals, and now claiming almost 90% of the entire South China Sea with over $5 trillion worth of commerce transits every year, and trying to claim territorial over that area makes absolutely no sense. In fact, it was the tribunal, International Tribunal in The Hague, in reigning on a case that was brought before us by the Philippines, which declared all of the Chinese claims as unlawful.
Admiral, there's a lot to digest there. Let's start with the military program, shall we? You've mentioned the seizure of these atolls and shoals and the like. and their fortification, as well as manufacturing these islands out of essentially nothing. When you look at that as one element of the Chinese military buildup, would you describe this for us as anything other than a bid to not only compete with, but to be able to defeat the United States military at sea, in the air, space, and elsewhere?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right, Frank. After all, you know, all you got to do is look at Xi Jinping's statement before the Communist Party 19th Congress, in which he declared it was his goal to make China a world power and a world-class military. And you have to translate that. What that means, in effect, is starting in 2020, they have plans to invade and annex Taiwan. This cannot be allowed to happen, and we'll get into that a little more. The other point I want to make that comes out of his speech that we must be cognizant of is they plan to overtake us not later than 2050. And this cannot be ignored. And of course, President Trump has much ground to recover as a result of the failed policies of not only the Obama administration, but his predecessors as well. And, you know, we watched how the Chinese infiltrate our system and have been able to steal our most advanced technology and certainly the latest revelations, which should be surprised to no one, on how they were able to hack into our Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's server and get instantaneous readout of every one of her emails, both coming and going. And then, of course, during that same period of time, miraculously, the Chinese were able to execute all of our undercover agents in China. Now, we are being cut from the inside. After all, what happened to our counterintelligence system? Nobody was able to figure this out. We're being sabotaged from within, and we've got to clean house, and we've got to do it now.
Well, again, you're putting a lot on the plate, and I want to go through it in some detail. But to just stay with the military for one more moment, Admiral, Xi Jinping has, as I understand it, actually talked about supplanting the United States as the dominant power in the world. This is a zero-sum game, as the political scientists say. It is going to be them or us, and they are determined that it is going to be them. 2050 sounds like a very long time from now, but I'm not sure this isn't going to happen a lot sooner than that, especially if, as you say, they are able to pull off an invasion of Taiwan. Admiral, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to get through a little bit more with you of the buildup, and then we will turn to some of these other very important points you've mentioned: theft of our intellectual property, hacking, and other espionage inside the United States, and much more right after this with Admiral James Ace Lyons.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have with us for the full hour an extraordinary American hero, a patriot of the first order, a man I've been privileged to know for the better part of 30 years at least, and work with closely in his capacity as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. He is Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is commenting with us today on, among other things, what is going on with China. It is now increasingly apparent, as he's made clear in our first segment, that the peaceful rise of China, which we have long been assured would be their ambition, is actually giving way. The mask is slipping, and their goal is supplanting the United States, defeating us, if not destroying us, if necessary, but certainly dominating us. And Admiral, I just wanted quickly, I've spoken on this program in recent weeks with a number of our colleagues, including notably Richard Fisher, who I know you've worked with closely for a long time, one of the country's preeminent authorities on China's military. But would you just characterize for us, sir, especially looking at it from the vantage point of an old SyncPAC fleet commander, what kind of order of battle is now developing in China and what it means not just for us in the Pacific, but quite far beyond?
They've had a double-digit military expansion program for the last two decades. And specifically, every one of their naval officers has read Mahan, who is the father of the United States Navy strategic thinking. So they've taken those lessons to heart.
And Mahan's thinking is basically that you need to be able to project power from the sea, right?
Exactly. And they've learned that lesson well. They've watched us. They study us. And they are now building a world-class global navy. They have one operating carrier and have four more they plan to at least build. And these, would, as I understand it, will be nuclear-powered. They have world-class ballistic missile submarine fleet, which certainly can threaten the United States today. And we have to take into consideration what we did to bring the Soviet similar threat down in the 80s. These have to be applied to the Chinese Navy as well. Although we don't have the resources and the buildup that's necessary to counter this massive Chinese threat. Also, we are being challenged, not only in the area of the maritime, but don't forget the air side of the equation as well. They have been able to steal our technology for our fifth and sixth generation aircraft, and they have been able to produce similar variants of those aircraft and challenge us every day in our operations, not only in the South China Sea, but in the air and the surrounding area. These, plus when they built these artificial islands, you know, Xi Jinping on September 25th, 2015 in the White House declared, we will never arm those artificial islands. Well, of course, we know how long that lasted. They now are fully armed. They have four 10,000-foot runways. Each one can accompany at least 26 aircraft. They have hypersonic anti-ship missiles on them now and 200 nautical miles surface-to-air missiles. All of this under the guise of peaceful coexistence, if you will, taking a turn from the Soviet era.
Yeah, a fraud, in other words. And Admiral Lyons, one of the things you just touched on there that I want to get a little bit further insight into is the Chinese nuclear forces. You mentioned they have a world-class ballistic missile fleet. There are also reports that they've gone to unbelievable lengths to build out their land-based missile capabilities. I'd like you to comment on that, and in particular against the backdrop of this idea that we continue, as I understand it, officially at least, as a government, to assess that they only have a couple hundred nuclear warheads, which would seem to be preposterous given what you've just discussed and what I hope you'll share with us about their land-based forces as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Frank, because the Chinese have over 3,000 miles underground reinforced tunnels in China for their strategic force.
The underground Great Wall, as they call it.
Yeah. And when I met with the former head of the Russian nuclear forces, I asked him personally, I said, how many strategic missiles do you all accredit China has? And this is 4 years ago now. He said, at that time, we estimate they had 1,600 to 1,700, while we continue to carry some figure like 300, which is pure nonsense. It makes no sense
These are warheads, not missiles, I believe.
Warheads, right. And the same way, you know, we talk about the North Korean threat. There'd be no North Korean nuclear threat if it wasn't for China. It's China that's providing the technology, the wherewithal, those 16-wheel TELs, the tractor erector launches, that give them the ability to launch a missile in 30 minutes instead of the 2 hours.
Yeah, from mobile locations that are hard to track, of course, too.
Exactly.
And Admiral, when you say that, I think it's important. We're hearing now increasingly that the administration is very frustrated with what's happening with North Korea, the so-called denuclearization that had been promised to President Trump has seemingly evaporated, not surprising to most of us, I guess, but it has, apparently. And there's no question in your mind, I take it, that that's really China engineering this. They clearly see a benefit to them of having a nuclear-armed North Korea, and that distracts us perhaps from their own nuclear threat, among other steps. Is that possible?
Well, absolutely, Frank. And let's, as I said in my recent op-ed, there's no question in my mind that Xi Jinping controls the nuclear codes for North Korea. And this is very, very significant. As you know, it's what goes on there. In the same way as we try to come to grips with this, and as you see, President Trump just preempted Mathis when Mathis said we would continue planning for our major exercises with South Korea. President Trump vetoed that and said there will be no further exercises.
Really? I had not heard that.
He just came out and said that. It is stunning when you see everything. You know, this the meeting in Singapore kind of reminds me of Obama's nuclear weapon agreement with Iran. We have our version. Iran has their version. The same thing with North Korea.
Well, the problem with North Korea, though, as I see it, is that we have not only the problem of China being very much a factor in this mix, but also of South Korea. And I just wonder, one of the things I was heartened about in the comments that former General, now Secretary Mattis, made about resuming our exercises there was we really need to brace up the South Korean government, because it seems increasingly under the sway of a very, very hard left, indeed pro-North Korean sort of administration. And there's, you know, an upcoming summit meeting between the two leaders, North and South Korea, and evidence that the South is determined, whatever the U.S. policy and posture might be, to normalize relations with the North fully and perhaps even pursue this idea of unification, presumably, largely on North Korea's terms. Your thoughts on the strategic import of all of that?
Well, it's shocking, to say the least, that what started out as an excellent initiative by the Trump administration has evolved now into being controlled totally, really, in my view, from Beijing. Make no mistake, when President Trump sat down with Kim Jong-un while he was at the table. We're really negotiating with China. Everything we're doing with North Korea, you've got to view it from the Chinese lens. And let's not leave Russia out of this equation, who also is another factor in helping avoid the tariffs and so forth that we've put on North Korea. Sustains their economy.
Yeah, essentially props up the regime. Yeah.
The other factor, never forget, North Korea is the offsite laboratory for Iran. Everything that North Korea has in nuclear weapons, you must assume Iran has it.
Right. And ballistic missiles, too. They've been joined at the hip on both of those programs. Admiral, we're going to have to pause in just a moment, but I did want to just pick up on something you alluded to there. Russia is very much involved with North Korea. It turns out Russia's seemingly determined to help advance China's military capabilities. They're conducting imminently the largest military exercises on a joint basis, no less, since the Cold War, including, it appears, the idea or the actual practice of nuclear weapons use, perhaps as part of an invasion of Taiwan, or perhaps to threaten, if not actually attack, the United States. These are extraordinarily ominous developments, needless to say, and I want to get a little bit more of your take on all of this, including what China is up to in a couple of other areas, espionage, influence operations, and economic warfare as well. We'll get into all of that with the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, James Ace Lyons. He is the hero, among other things, of a marvelous book by former Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, entitled Oceans Ventured. Back with more with Admiral Lyons right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, a distinguished naval officer, a great patriot who is continuing to provide incalculably important service to his country, notably in op-eds that he now writes with regularity at the Canadian Free Press, and also in his work, I'm proud to say, as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. Admiral Lyons, we've talked about China's ambitions. We've talked about some of the steps that they're taking to act on those ambitions, particularly in the military space. I wanted to come back, though, to something you talked about a moment ago in terms of some of the other non-kinetic but very, very dangerous things that they're also doing. Let's start with espionage. You mentioned recent revelations about their penetration of Hillary Clinton's email servers and the real-time downloads that they were getting of her correspondence, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, the rolling up of our intelligence assets in China with murderous effect for some of our agents there. What else do we know about what the Chinese have been up to? For example, with respect to Senator Dianne Feinstein and their sort of use of Chinese nationals, students and illegal aliens and others to serve as collectors for them as well.
Yeah, well, you know, they've sent up thousands of Confucius centers throughout our universities and throughout the country. These are all intelligence gathering and influence operations. They have a massive effort going on. What do we have? Over 300,000 Chinese students in our universities. Each one has the potential for providing valuable key information back to the motherland. Let's face it. I mean, this, I don't want to gloss over lightly on the penetration they had on our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton's unsecured server, in which they were able to get almost instantaneous readout on every one of her emails, both in and out of that server. I mean, this is unbelievable. And the same way with the driver for Dianne Feinstein, and it's more than a driver. He was the office manager. So let's not push off. This guy knew everything that was going on in her San Francisco office. He had great access to everything. I mean, this is a this setup that they had is an intelligence dream that you could only that came true. Such penetration is unbelievable, and our counterintelligence did not pick up on any of this. And what was the result? We lost all of our undercover agents in China within a 2-year period during Hillary Clinton's reign as Secretary of State. They were all exposed.
This is a sample of a much larger problem, of course, as you know, Admiral Lyons. In fact, you've written recently about it. The dire straits in which we now find ourselves in terms of counterintelligence tradecraft, skilled personnel and capabilities. And the enemy, whether it's the Chinese or the Russians, or for that matter, the North Koreans or the Iranians, taking advantage of this. Perhaps you could throw into that mix the Pakistanis too, with their seeming penetration of Capitol Hill with that House IT scandal. But let me come back to something you touched on as well, Admiral, and that is these influence operations. The Confucius Institutes are one piece of it. The Chinese have also been adept over the years at using companies that seek to do business with China as agents of influence as well. Would you talk about that, sort of the cumulative effect of all of these advocates for China, the so-called panda huggers in the think tanks, not least?
It is tragic that we've allowed ourselves and our companies to get in the position they have, because these companies, when they wanted to do a business in China, were forced under the Chinese rule to give up their technology. I mean, we were for sale. And it's unbelievable what we're... I want to go back to the President Bill Clinton's tenure. After all, what did he do there? With Schwartz from Laurel, the Chinese intercontinental missiles were blowing up. They had a fatal flaw. So what did Clinton do, which wound up in great contributions to his campaign? He provided them with the technology to fix their missiles, which target us today.
And actually make them capable of delivering multiple warheads as well, as I recall. A scandal. So when you see Hillary Clinton's behavior, you realize it didn't fall far from the tree, as they say. And Admiral, when you look at the cumulative effect of all of this, the economic warfare, really, of which you've really just touched on a piece, the theft or the simple outright expropriation of American technology, in addition to essentially buying the voices of American companies, they have put a lot of them out of business, have they not? The manufacturing base that Donald Trump talks about a lot in this country, having migrated much of it to China, is a product, it would seem, of a sort of comprehensive, unrestricted warfare strategy, as our friend Kevin Freeman has observed, right?
Absolutely. In fact, go further, even some of the strategic material and metals that we require, China has great control over those.
These are rare earth minerals, among other things, right?
Exactly. We're being, as we started out and say, and you mentioned it, we're being challenged on all fronts, economically, militarily, technologically. It's unbelievable what's going on.
Yep. And just a last point on all of this, Admiral, as you look around the world, and again, you've alluded to this specifically in connection with the South China Sea and the Belt and Road Initiative, isn't it the case that the Chinese strategy for power projection, that Mahanian plan, if you will, involves essentially taking up strategic positions worldwide, including in our own hemisphere, for heaven's sakes, as well as in places that we have to be able to operate, whether it's the Persian Gulf or whether it's the North Atlantic, perhaps, certainly the Caribbean, the Panama Canal? Just give us a flavor as a world-class strategist, sir, with long experience with naval operations as well as, more broadly, national security planning. How does that look to you, taken together with all of the other things that we've just talked about?
Well, it is shocking that we've allowed ourselves to get in the position that we're in today. Let's face it, China controls the Panama Canal. Both ports at either end of the canal are controlled by China. They've poured billions of dollars in to expand the Panama Canal.
And just, Admiral, very quickly, forgive me for interrupting you, but what does that mean in terms of the U.S. Navy, the size of our fleet, as well as its deployment?
Well, we've got the Panama Canal is key to us transferring our naval assets from either the east to the west coast and vice versa. Otherwise, you've got to add 2 weeks on to your transit to go around South America if we're denied access to that strategic waterway called that Jimmy Carter gave away to Nicaragua, to Panama in during his reign.
Mm-hmm. This is a dire picture, needless to say, Admiral, and one that I think every American should recognize requires a very focused and concerted effort. And from what you've seen so far of the Trump administration, is the president getting this problem of China right, at least in broad outlines? And are we doing nearly enough to sort of counteract what has been set in train now for quite some time, going back, some say, to 1991, when Deng Xiaoping said, we're now entering into a Cold War with the United States, and unlike the Soviet Union, we're going to win it.
Yeah, he has a long way to go. He certainly is focused in the right direction. I propose that we need, as part of our overall strategy, to have a NATO-like alliance in the Western Pacific. And the Trump administration has moved in that direction by calling for Australia, Japan, India, and the United States to form a Quad. But, of course, that has to be expanded. When I say a NATO-like alliance, I'm talking the foundation of that has got to be mutual defense treaties with South Korea, Japan, the Philippines. And I proposed, and I support Gordon Chang's, that we have a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. In other words, as he said and I said in my op-ed, any attack on Taiwan, we consider an attack on the United States. We have to draw these very clear red lines so there can be no mistake in the strategic thinking of China and what our response will be. We can't make the same mistake we made with South Korea and, or that matter, for Kuwait,
where we signaled at a key moment in both cases that we were disinterested in what happened in those places. And lo and behold, enemies took advantage of those statements to act very much to our detriment. Admiral, we have to pause for one last break. This is a sobering picture you've painted, needless to say. It is imperative, it seems to me, that the Trump administration make a redoubled effort to act on the kinds of recommendations you've talked about. And it seems to me it's imperative that we not only draw those red lines, but that we have the forces in place to back them up. We'll talk more about that and also so much more with Admiral Lyons, notably about Iran in the final segment with him. Admiral James Ace Lyons, United States Navy, retired, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking with one of the heroes of the Cold War, by my lights, and more to the point, by the lights of the former Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, who features prominently in his terrific book, Oceans Ventured, the daring do and exploits at sea of Admiral James Ace Lyons. He is the former Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, among many senior positions he held in the United States Navy and the Pentagon. He is also, these days, I'm proud to say, the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, also the president of Lyon Associates, LLC. Admiral Lyons, we could go on and on about China and what needs to be done there, but I did want to come back to something that you spoke of a moment ago in connection with North Korea, and that is Iran. In the course of your distinguished career, you dealt a lot with the threat that was then relatively nascent compared to what we're facing today from Iran, especially as a result of its partnership, strategic alliance, really, with the North Koreans. Give us your sense, sir, as things stand now, where we are vis-a-vis Iran, the threat that it poses to our interests as well as to our allies, and indeed perhaps to us as well, and what we should be doing about it, as you see it.
Well, as you've recently seen with the new economic sanctions we've imposed on Iran, they have threatened to close the Straits of Hormuz. I don't think we have sufficient resources in the region now to deter such a move by Iran. And we need to beef up our resources there and elsewhere. But let's face it, Iran remains a danger as long as the Iranian theocracy remains in power. We have great unrest in Iran. We should be capitalizing on fomenting and supporting the efforts of the Iranian people to get rid of the Iranian theocracy. There may even be splits within the military that we could co-op. But again, I'm concerned about what's happened to our intelligence services, our undercover operations, our Open Voice of America on the Farsi network and so forth, which is still being dominated by Obama holdovers and not working in support of the Trump administration.
And effectively, that amounted under the previous administration, and to some extent, I think even under the Bush administration, to a sort of pro-Tehran Persian language network, incredible as that sounds, being underwritten and operated by taxpayer-supported agencies. Admiral Lyons, when you look at Iran at the moment and the threats that they're now making to the Strait of Hormuz, but also what they have managed to do through proxies known as the Houthi rebels in Yemen to the Bab al-Mandab Strait with the entry to the Red Sea. These, we speak of choke points, these are places in which enormous damage can be done to the, well, the commerce of the free world, but also to our national security. Would you just talk a little bit about the implications of this choke point threatening capability of the Iranians and what we have to be doing about it, as you see it?
Well, it's we only have so many strategic waterways. Like, when you control the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, you're also you have the effect of control over the Suez Canal. And that cannot be ignored, nor can we allow Iran to affect this type of control. And, you know, Iran, it's not just Iran. Co-aligned with Iran is China in all of this. You know, we can't ignore their role. They are the greatest importer of Iranian oil. This is sustaining that theocracy. It's just like China, who has built this strategic port and in the process of building it, at Gwadar in Pakistan, which gives them a strategic position to intercept anything and can help control the Persian Gulf, the entrance to the Straits of Hormuz. And the same way with the Bab el-Mandeb, because what has China done? They built the base over in Djibouti, the opposite side of the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. And really great, they have great efforts going on throughout all of Africa. I mean, this is a massive effort that can't be ignored. And we're not fostering. We have to increase our alliances. We have to increase the way we build up our military forces. We have a tremendous job ahead of us, but we're being undercut by many of these efforts from inside. It's just like, and I use this as a prime example. Here we know the Chinese were instantly reading out Hillary's email server. And who came out and just debunked that? But our own FBI said, oh, no, nothing like that ever happened. And the same way, they couldn't find any of the problems with the Awan brothers and Capitol Hill, who had penetrated over 44 congressional offices.
Yeah, quite possibly on behalf of the Pakistani intelligence services, you've written, Admiral. Listen, two quick points before we let you go, Admiral. And as always, we've been so appreciative of your time. I saw on the front page of the Washington Times yesterday that the United States Navy has reinstated the Second Fleet, which, if memory serves, you commanded at one point, in order to deal with Russia's rising threat in the Atlantic and in the Arctic. Just a quick word about the importance of that step and what else needs to be done in that regard.
It's long overdue. We've ignored the Soviet buildup and the threat it poses to us, not only in the North Atlantic, but as you point out, Frank, in the Arctic, and which is the new economic waterway that is being developed quite rapidly by Russia. The Second Fleet is key to projecting power into not only the North Atlantic, but above the Arctic Circle, and threatening, if you will, the Russian homeland bases and so forth. This is what we were able to do under the Reagan administration. And it's the same thing. What Reagan faced in the North Atlantic in 1981 is exactly, it's very similar to what President Trump is faced with in the South China Sea. And again, it takes a lot of bold initiative, and you can't be doing onesie or twosie type of operations. You've got to have massive operations. When I took the first fleet operation into the North, I had over 250 ships and over 1,000 aircraft in that first ocean venture operation. We have to do massive type of exercises again to raise the level of deterrence. This has to be done not only in the North Atlantic, Norwegian Sea, but also in the South China Sea. This is how you raise deterrence.
Well, it is, Admiral, but I regret to point out, as you know better than anybody, the number of ships that you had under your command in either that operation in Ocean's Venture or in the Pacific is roughly what we have in the entire fleet of the United States Navy today. So we've got to be about fixing that, needless to say. Hey, listen, one last quick question, sir. You've warned in some of your writings recently, I believe in the Canadian Free Press, about another problem here at home that has potentially profound strategic downsides, and that is the decision to allow not just the Chinese, but even a company that is co-owned by the family of Saddam Hussein's bomb maker, for heaven's sakes, to run American container operations in some of our key ports. Just a quick word about the advisability of such actions and what we best be doing about that.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, Frank, because let's see, under the Obama administration, we gave a 35-year lease to Dr. Jafar, Jafar's brother. We actually gave these to Hamad Jafar, and his brother is Dr. Jafar, who was Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons expert and developer of the Beach Ball. And the Beach Ball is a miniature nuclear warhead.
Staggering. Admiral, we are hard out of time, I'm sorry to say. It is always the case that there's vastly more to talk with you about than there is time to do it. So I hope you will come back to us again very soon. We're always so appreciative of your expertise as well as the generosity of your time with us. Godspeed, sir. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.